This is Latin Pulse, a weekly analysis of news and public affairs in Latin America. Brought to you in cooperation with American University's School of Communication in Washington, D.C. and Link TV. And now here's host, Rick Rockwell.
Bienvenidos and welcome to Latin Pulse. This week we have elections, democracy, and social change on our docket, plus some breaking news of sorts. The program will feature an in-depth interview looking ahead to this weekend's elections in Argentina, and we'll also have news about Cuba and its latest wave of economic reforms. But first, major decisions in Venezuela this week that put fair elections and free media at risk. Vanessa Jesus-Gonzalez is here with the details and this week's news highlights from around Latin America.
This week, the Venezuelan Supreme Court disregarded the Inter-American Court of Human Rights' decision to allow opposition leader Leopoldo López to run for office. The Comptroller General banned López, a former Caracas district mayor, from running for public office in 2008 because of corruption allegations. However, in September, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled in López's favor when he appealed his case. He has never been formally prosecuted or convicted on allegations. Luis Manuel Espinosa, a former advisor of Leopoldo López, says the candidate still intends to run because the Inter-American Court's decision is legally binding.
This gentleman's rights have been fully restored because they didn't find anything on him, and they would have always been so in all sensible countries in the world.
Venezuela's Supreme Court says he is allowed to run, but that if he won, it is not assured that he could take office. Venezuela's telecommunications regulator, CONATEL, fined the openly critical television network Globovisión. The institution says Globovisión has to pay 7% of its gross income for violating Venezuela's media laws during the coverage of confrontation in a prison near Caracas in June and July. The television network says it will appeal the fine that would otherwise make them go bankrupt. The fine adds up to $2 million. According to CONATEL, the station violated the law by creating anxiety and instigating intolerance for political reasons. Latest polls show that Argentina's president, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, is most likely to be re-elected during Sunday's election. According to Jacobe and Asociados, the president has the support of 53% of voters, while opposition challenger and governor, Hermes Biner, comes in second with almost 17%. Fernández has been in power for the past 4 years, following her husband, who served in office from 2003 to 2007 and passed away last year. Argentina has been enjoying its longest period of democracy since a series of coups in the 1930s and one of its most sustained periods of economic growth. Cuba's dissident Laura Pollan died at 63 of a cardiorespiratory failure, a week after being hospitalized. The community gathered to mourn the loss of one of its most prominent leaders and founder of the Ladies in White. For years, Pollan made her home headquarters for planning protests against the communist regime. Pollan founded the group in 2003 with Berta Soler to press for the release of their husbands and more than 70 other activists from Cuban prisons. After that, the Ladies in White continued to protest against the government, which calls the women traitors working for the United States. There was no mention of Pollan's death in Cuban state media. Students protest for changes in the education system in Santiago, Chile. Two marches approved by authorities converged in a demonstration in Chile's capital, and after small groups confronted the police, violence broke out. A group of students attacked a gas station and spread gasoline around. A few protesters also tried to set an empty bus on fire. Some student leaders condemn the violence and wonder who is really behind these activities. After months of protests, President Sebastián Piñera has denied the students' main demand that Chile provide free public education to all citizens. A week of heavy rains across Central America caused landslides, floods, and bridge collapses. At least 84 people have died, and 9 are missing, authorities say. El Salvador and Nicaragua leaders declared natural disasters on Monday. the rains have affected about 250,000 people. I'm Vanessa Jesus Gonzati reporting for Latin Pulse.
This week we have some breaking news. Today, Freedom House, the international organization focused on democracy and free speech, released its latest study on Cuba. The study calls the recent economic reforms in Cuba the most significant changes to the island since communism arrived in 1959. The study is based upon a poll of 190 Cubans conducted in Cuba during June in six of the island's provinces and focusing upon the economic liberalizations of the government of Raul Castro. Joining us to discuss the findings is the study's co-author, Daniel Kallengart. Welcome to Latin Pulse. Please tell us a bit more about the study and why the poll points to this major shift in public attitudes toward these economic reforms.
Well, I should start out by saying that Freedom House has done a series of surveys in Cuba, and the most recent one was, or there's the one that we're releasing now. Previous to this, we had a field study done in December of last year. And the shift in attitudes between even the end of last year and the field study fielded this June is really quite significant. And the general picture that emerged 10 months ago was that people did not think that change was real. They had heard announcements. They didn't really see much changing. And they were very skeptical about even the idea of change. What we see now is that change is very real. Four in five of those people that we surveyed said that they have seen changes taking place in recent months in Cuba. Many point to the cuenta propistas, the self-employed, and I think it was about two-thirds of respondents know someone who has applied for and received a license, and they say they see these street vendors on every corner. And what's more significant is not just these changes in small-scale private enterprise, but it's really a change in attitudes, that suddenly change is real and it is affecting how people think. So to just give a couple of examples, please. One of the people interviewed sells food on the street, and she's aspiring to setting up her own little restaurant so people can come in and sit at the table and she'd have a nice tablecloth. There's another person that we interviewed who is an architect, and she sees that these licenses for what they call self-employment are provided for really unskilled jobs like selling on the street or hairdressers or the and she's asking, why can't I get a license to be an architect to help build houses? So she's looking forward to that. So people are not talking as they did in the past about, you know, maybe there'll be reforms, and if even if they are, they might get rolled back. People are talking as if this is here to stay, and we're looking for more.
I want to go back to one of the major statements in the conclusion, that this is perhaps the most significant economic and, I guess, socioeconomic shift in Cuba since the revolution. That's a pretty bold statement.
It is a significant change. I mean, people think back to the period in the 90s when there was an opening and it got rolled back. Our sense is that this is here to stay. And partly it's from the attitudes that Cubans are expressing in the surveys, that they're looking forward. They're not even bringing up the concern that this might be rolled back. And also, the context is different, where the leaders are all in or near their 80s. And when Cubans talk about change now, they're not talking about if, they're talking about when. And they're saying, well, maybe we got to wait a few years for these old guys to go, but they're expecting it to happen.
I should mention to our listeners just a technical point, that this week Daniel Kallengart is joining us from his office in Washington, D.C. He's not here in our studio. He's joining us via Skype. And so some of the technical quality may be a little different than what we're used to. But in some ways, this is a bit of a metaphor for what we're talking about in Cuba, that these technical changes are a little bit different than what we've heard in the past from the Cuban government through this special period. We've done a number of programs that have mentioned these Cuban economic changes and mentioned the mood on the island. And one of the things I think that's interesting about your poll is that there's a sense of optimism, and that's something new when we talk about Cuba.
Very much so. I used to joke when we did the previous polls and we would be designing them, and I'd almost wonder, why should we do another poll on Cuba? What we're going to find out is nothing changes and everyone's depressed. And what we found in this most recent poll is very different. Just a couple of examples. About 2/3 of the respondents welcomed the reforms. And when we asked people, do you think the country is moving forward, or is it stuck, or is it moving backward? The percentage who said it is moving forward has increased from 15% in the last poll to 41% this poll. Now, of course, that means that most Cubans still think the country is stuck, but just the big leap in optimism is really quite substantial. And what's more is that when we ask people, what do you think will happen in the next 12 months? Are your economic conditions going to get better? We see quite a significant number expecting things to get better. And this also goes to your earlier question, why this is a change that it's here to stay, because people expect more. So it both means that if the reforms don't deliver, it's likely that Cubans are going to push for deeper changes.
We've done some reporting on this program in the recent past about the fact that Cubans are now going to be able to sell automobiles privately, something that they weren't able to do before, and that real estate sales are down the pike. So those sorts of changes are coming. And I'm wondering, is this sort of change going to spur some of the Cuban populace to ask for even more change, not necessarily economic changes? Isn't there a part of the study that talks about other changes that Cubans would like to see?
Exactly. We see that while this optimism is growing and expectations are rising, we also see more interest and demand for personal freedoms. So, for instance, we've asked in the past, what is the reform that you would most like to see? And in the past, most of the answers we got had to do with economic reform, had to do with improving living conditions. In this survey, the most frequent answer had to do with freedom of expression, freedom to travel, basically civil liberties.
I want to ask you a little bit about how you conduct a poll in Cuba, an authoritarian state. 190 interviews, I think, is actually significant in that particular climate. Some people might say that's a fairly small sample size. So tell us a little bit about how you conduct a poll like this and how accurate you think it is.
Well, I should say straight off that this is not a scientific sample. So we were operating under very significant constraints, as you said, and what it does is it provides the best information we can get under the circumstances. The other challenge is that we can't do it openly and openly record and ask these questions. So it's more sort of conversational interviews. The questions that are included in the study, and incidentally, the full study is posted on the Freedom House website.
I'd like to ask you your personal opinion, perhaps built upon what you've written about in this particular study, which is, where does Cuba go from here? Does this mean that we're going to see some of those reforms that people are asking for, freedom of movement, freedom of speech, or are you hopeful about that?
Personally, I am. I think there's a real concern that it might not change as much and as quickly as we would like. I mean, my guess is that the Cuban government wants to create a Chinese model where you have private enterprise, but politically it remains as repressive as it is now. I think there's also a risk that even if there is some political change, that it won't be a full move to democracy because, you know, there's still a lot of power, including money and resources within the ruling clique. So you could have, you know, a different kind of model that's sort of a crony capitalist model. But I really get the sense that that we're starting to see more demand for individual freedom, and that may start to open up consideration of even political change. And the reason is this, that in previous surveys, we really got the sense that people didn't see that they had much control over their destiny. You know, they were so dependent on the state. And, you know, when you ask them about, you know, what would you like to see? What do you want to change? They were just very passive. With the introduction of the private market, or really the expansion of the private market, people are just talking differently. They're talking as people who, at least in an economic sphere, can make a difference. They're saying, you know, if I work hard, I can do better. And they're talking about property and saying, you know, if something is yours, you take care of it. And this is also happening at a time when people are expressing more interest in free speech and being able to travel. And the travel is not necessarily, you know, I want to emigrate, I want to get out of here. No, they want to see other parts of the world. And sometimes they want to go work in another country for a few years and earn and then bring the money back. But, you know, they're thinking more as individuals and more as people who have some influence, if not control, over their personal destiny.
Daniel Kallengard of Freedom House, thank you very much for joining us on Latin Pulse via Skype today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
A restless energy blows across the globe.
The desire for human rights.
Yet every day, people are tortured,
imprisoned,
executed, or disappeared.
Simply for their identity or their beliefs.
That's why Amnesty International speaks out.
To protect people's basic human rights.
To change the sounds of suffering
to the sounds of freedom.
Call 1-800-AMNESTY.
It's your human right.
1-800-AMNESTY.
Welcome back to Latin Pulse. Up next, we have excerpts from a pre-recorded interview with Andres Servín of Buenos Aires. Servín is a noted anthropologist and political scientist who's retired from his position at Central University in Venezuela and is now back home in Argentina. There he runs CRIES, a network of 70 non-governmental organizations and university research centers throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. He visited Washington, D.C. recently as part of a study on Latin American integration and the decline of U.S. power throughout the hemisphere. And that's when we found time for an interview in our studio. The decline of U.S. influence in Latin America has been something we've been dealing with on this program for several weeks. And my question, I guess, off the bat is this something new? Is this transition to a different sort of Latin American integration and relationship with the United States that we've seen in the past? Or is this just the cycle of the U.S. moving away from Latin America, as it tends
to
do?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. What is happening is that increasingly the South American countries particularly are developing more autonomy from the United States and the hemispheric system, and at the same time promoting new forms of integration first on a South American level and then on a Latin American level. And this is the traditional tension between two visions about the integration in the hemisphere. One is the Pan-American vision, which includes, of course, the United States particularly and Canada. And the other one is a more Latin American approach. Some can call it Bolivarian in terms of the thinking of Bolivar, not necessarily in terms of what's going on now in Venezuela. So It happens that for the last 10 years there had been a proliferation of new forum, of political forum in Latin America that created the conditions for the emergence of some new forms of integration. One of them is UNASUR, the Union of South American Countries, which started in 2008 and which has a very successful record in terms of solving and settling disputes within the region. And in this regard, it's becoming a sort of competition with the Organization of American States, which responds to this vision of the Pan-American hemisphere.
And what is the vision of this new, I guess, multi-state organization, if we were going to characterize it? Is it the new Bolivarian vision of Venezuela? Is it the vision of Brazil? Is it the vision of the Southern Cone from Argentina and Chile, or is it truly a mix?
Well, first of all, is the building of, I wouldn't say a new identity, but a South American identity as part of a new community, which is South America. And of course, in the process of building this new identity and promoting this new process of integration, there is a competition between two leaderships. One is, of course, Venezuela with its projects, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, ALBA, which includes not only South American countries, but also Caribbean and Central American countries, and the vision of Brazil, based mostly on the experience of Mercosur, of integrating the South American countries and one community, and switching maybe the agenda from the traditional view of integration as related to free trade and liberalization to a more political approach, where there are, well, we consider that there are three returns that are very important. First of all, the return to the state. The state is playing a more important role than the market, for example. The second one is the return of politics. There is a lot of meetings between the leaders and the presidents in the region trying to build consensus about different issues of the regional agenda. And thirdly, the return to the development agenda, which is associated also with social policies.
So this axis of power between Brazil or between Venezuela, none of the other countries seem to have an equal standing then in this new vision.
The point is that Brazil is still hesitant between choosing to be a global player and basing this global projection on a regional platform, and for that end, building and strengthening the process in South America, and a vision by Chavez, which particularly by Chavez, I wouldn't say by Venezuela, of the community of Latin American nations, which has a more ideological orientation and has to do mostly with the influence within the region.
Since you brought up politics, we would be remiss, because the Argentine elections are just on our doorstep. Can we talk a little bit about the political situation in Argentina, since your roots are in Argentina?
Well, what is happening in Argentina is that we have an unusual long period of stability, political and economic stability, after the crisis in 2001-2002. And there is an economic growth, so the people feels that the economy is doing well. And as a result, the president probably is going to win the next election, as was showed by the primaries that we have 2 months ago. She got about 50% of the vote, and eventually probably she's going to have some 2% more in the elections. On one side, there is the success story of the government for the last years, and the support of the Peronist movement, which is very heterogeneous, but is very important for the process of election.
And I think for our audience, we have to make sure that they understand that the current government in Argentina is a Peronist government.
It's a Peronist government, yeah. And then the second important factor is that you have a very fragmented opposition. Part of this opposition came from the Peronist movement, and it's in opposition to the president and their project as such, her project as such. So what is emerging is a new alternative, the Socialist Party, which happens to have a very successful government in the province of Santa Fe, is one of the richest provinces in Argentina. And the most interesting thing is that it's the only government that in the recent 30 years has no complaints of abuse of power or of corruption. So it's not going to be a competition in the next election to the president, but it's an emerging important force, this of the Socialist Party, which is mostly a social democratic party.
And would you put them on the political scale farther to the left than the Peronists currently?
Not necessarily. This is a moderate left that has a very good experience of managing a province and probably can be in office with some degree of success. But there is another kind of consideration in this case, particularly the political consideration. Sometimes the stability of a government doesn't depend on their ability to deliver the goods, but of their ability to negotiate with some political factors that are very important in Argentina. One of them, for example, are the trade unions.
And is this one of the reasons why the current president is going to win this election, because people are confident in this type of stability that you pointed out?
Yes, I think that the president managed to establish some sort of I wouldn't say a good relationship, but some sort of relationship.
Because she's had some problems with strikes that have shut down parts of the country at times.
That's part of the process of struggling between the government and the main trade union confederation.
So anything that an American audience should know about this predicted outcome, does this just mean more stability and more recovery from the economic crisis in Latin America for Argentina, or is there another prediction from you?
No, I would say that in the short term, we can predict more stability, and all depends of how the economy is going to evolve, particularly taking into account the international financial crisis and the possibility that, well, Argentina, the most important export, of course, are commodities, and particularly to China. And also some products more manufactured to Brazil.
Well, we'll see next week if the prediction comes true. Mm-hmm. Other people have been on this program and have predicted the same, that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner will be the winner. No.
And then we'll see what happens afterwards.
Indeed. Thank you very much for joining us today, Andre Servin, a political scientist from both Argentina and Venezuela.
Thank you.
Latin Pulse is available on the web and via iTunes. And to see the Latin Pulse archives on video programs on Latin America, you can check out Link TV's website, linktv.org, and then /Latin Pulse, also all one word. That's linktv.org/Latin Pulse. And if you'd like to write us with your reactions to our program, please send us an email. You can find us at latinpulse.gmx.com. That's latinpulse, all one word, .gmx.com. Thank you for joining us this week on Latin Pulse. For associate producer Vanessa Jesus-Gonzati and announcer Victor Kilo, I'm Rick Rockwell. Escucha nos otra vez. Gracias por su tiempo.
Latin Pulse is produced in Washington, D.C. at American University School of Communication and with the support of Link TV. Theme music provided by Link TV and additional music from Canary Productions and Bath Time Music Publishing.
This program is copyright 2011, Las Rocas Productions.